The row between the UK and France continues over fishing rights. The UK says it reserves the right to respond in a proportionate way to France's detention of a British trawler in French waters. This is while France has said the boat detained lacked proper license. Paris has even threatened more measures, maybe even sanctions, if London denies fishing license to French boats operating in British waters. To explain first more about the developments on this story, Rob Carter is our correspondent, who joins us from London. Well, Rob, we've seen the heated words being exchanged here. Tell us the latest, if you can, on this.
This year, France could be slapping significant sanctions on the UK. These sanctions could start off small, but France has also made clear that they're looking at a second round of sanctions if the first sanctions should happen to come into place and the UK still fails to change its policy regarding licenses for French fishermen to operate in disputed waters, waters which, of course, the UK lays claim to, but that France believes their fishermen should also have access to. This dispute may sound minor over fishing rights, but ultimately this is a territorial battle taking place between what are supposed to be two of Europe's biggest allies. And of course, this boils down to the aftermath of a very heated and contentious Brexit debate, which plagued relations between Britain and the continent for years and still continues to do so. But also the fact that the relationship afterwards appears to have not repaired itself like many of the Brexiteers claimed that it would. In fact, there is a lot of resentment which still remains. This battle has been escalating. We've already seen British and French fishermen clashing their boats over disputed scallop fishing zones. We've actually seen security vessels dispatched to disputed zones in order to police the situation. And of course, now we are talking about potential sanctions being implemented. These sanctions are wide-ranging. They could affect extra checks on British trucks entering in and out of the Channel Tunnel, which of course would add to major delays and things like that. So economic consequences could hit Britain if they don't come to some kind of solution here. Britain, on the other hand, is under a lot of pressure. It's pitted against France on numerous issues, but ultimately the British electorate have essentially demanded from their government that they protect British borders, that they take a hardline stance against the continent, and ultimately that means that Boris Johnson can only compromise to such an extent before he'll start receiving criticism at home for being too weak. So what could happen is Britain and France could be forced in a situation where rather than the option of de-escalation is not an option, and they may have to keep battling it out to figure out who is more tougher and which ego is ultimately going to win this standoff.
Interesting way you're putting that. Thank you for that, Rob Carter. Let's introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have the former Member of Parliament of the United Kingdom, Derek Conway, who joins us from London. Also joining us is Chairman of the Board of BWA, Michael Schumann, who joins us from Verona.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'd like to welcome you both, and if I can start with our guest in Verona, Michael Schumann. What are we looking at here? Are we looking at something that's going to boil over, or our correspondent had a very interesting way of relaying the news, where he said that de-escalation is not an option, and we have to see whose ego is going to win.
Well, to let me put it bluntly, de-escalation must always be an option, because we can simply not afford in Europe to have this escalate further. Looking at this role, which your correspondent described rightly so as a territorial battle, it doesn't come much as a surprise. I mean, of course, we all know how sticky, what a sticky point fishing rights was in the Brexit negotiations. But underlying this, what we see right now is something that, you know, we predicted from the beginning of the Brexit discussion, that once you are willing to sacrifice European integration lightheartedly, old historical conflicts that haunted Europe in the past for quite a while, they will break up again. This is what we're looking at right now. And this is something very, very disturbing.
Derek Conway, you heard our guest there. What are your thoughts about this in terms of basically ultimately coming down to who's right and who's wrong?
Well, I think it all seems quite childish. I'd like to be able to say to you that I think the British government is being very well behaved and honourable and good, and the French are just being stupid and unreasonable. But the fact is, both sides of this dispute are behaving in a very intemperate and silly way. The French really have got a very weak argument, because over 98% of the fishing licences have been issued, and that's presumably why the European Union is not getting involved, which it usually would. But by the same token, they're completely overreacting to the situation, and I think the British government probably just needs to talk it down a bit, because the French have got a very contentious election for the president coming up in the early part of next year, and that's going to make tensions very high as the country sort of swings to the right politically, and it's probably best for the British government to just try and calm things down a bit if it possibly can. But if the French are determined to be belligerent, then these aren't British waters, and therefore the French haven't got a strong case.
Well, what are we looking at in terms of the French statements here of what they're going to do? I mean, if we are going to take a look, Michael Schumann, at the French actions, it's going to involve sanctions, possibly. Are they going to go to that extent?
Possibly. I wouldn't rule it out, but even if they're not, you know, if you just look at the rhetoric that has been used these days, I mean, that's unbelievable. Would you have guessed that we see this kind of confrontation in the heart of Europe, like the French European minister saying we need to speak the language of force, the French threatening to cut off Jersey from electricity supplies in the middle of an energy crisis? I think, you know, no matter whether they move along with it, that belligerent as they have been or not, the fact that you hear this kind of rhetoric in the heart of Europe, that should really disturb us. And I, here in Verona, we've been at the Economic Eurasian Forum for the last 2 days discussing the state of the European Union, of European integration. And tell you something, I feel quite uneasy. As I said, these are all historical conflicts coming back up. And we give away that idea that European integration preserved peace too lightheartedly with Brexit, but also now if you look at the Brussels stance on Poland or on Hungary, we play with fire here.
Okay, since we're talking about inflammatory statements, Derek Conway, let's take a look at Paris's warning that it could impose time-consuming, what it says, checks on all products, and a ban on UK vessels from what we're seeing here, landing seafood at French ports. The UK, meanwhile, has said that, aside from accusing France of inflammatory language, that it did not rule out blocking French vessels from landing their catches in the UK. Who would suffer more economically here? I mean, could that speak as to which direction this is going to go?
I think, sadly, it almost doesn't matter. I mean, while the COP26 summit is going on in Glasgow this coming week, the British government will want to try and keep things calm until that's over. But the British are by instinct a belligerent people, and the French for 1,000 years have had unhelpful relations from time to time with the Brits, and have always come off worse. And that's because Britain doesn't do well being bullied. The British people by instinct would be more than happy to take a hit economically, culturally, in every other respect if the French are pushing too hard. And so sometimes you have to take this sort of Gallic exuberance and diplomatically say, well, that's the French, that's how they behave, their arms are everywhere, they get excited over nothing, so it's just the French. But this could turn quite serious fairly soon, and I think in December, if you see French ports being blocked, well, I think because of the European Union, you'll find Rotterdam is used more by those trying to gain access to the UK market. The French market with the UK is huge. Millions of French people live in Britain. Millions of Britons are tourists in France in usual circumstances, their largest group of visitors. And so this would harm both countries. But if that's how the French want to play it, then the instinct of my fellow countrymen to say is, if you're big enough, have a swing. And I think that's how it will go. It wouldn't surprise me at all if this deteriorates further over a relatively minor issue, really, and in the scheme of things. I mean, economically, fishing is not an important industry to Britain financially, but it is emotionally, and that's where the trouble comes.
Okay, I'm going to ask both of our guests here to maybe do something for us. So first, I'm going to start with you, Michael Schumann. Supposedly, there's going to be this meeting between the French President Emmanuel Macron and the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Let's say that you, Michael Schumann, are the French President, and Derek Conway is the British Prime Minister, and you're getting together. What would you be telling him in order to de-escalate, as you said, it should go that route or not? What type of conversation would you have? Go ahead, Michael Schumann, you first. And Derek Conway, in response to what he's going to ask you or say.
Well, that's quite difficult for me to answer because, as you know, I'm the board chairman of the German Industry Association, so I would probably recommend to call in Angela Merkel if she was still there to help and mediate, because it needs to be worked out. It needs to be de-escalated. We can't really say that de-escalation is not an option on the table. Both sides need to find a solution in the interest of stability in Europe in a very challenging time. I mean, we're looking at one of the worst challenges of the energy crisis that we have had in years, besides the pandemic. And I think this should not be on the table right now.
Derek Conway.
Well, Mr. President, I know you don't have a high regard for me as Prime Minister in Britain, and you think I'm a bit of a joker, and most of the time I am a bit of a joker. But on this, you had better understand that Britain is very serious indeed. And although you have a difficult election to face with the National Front in France, and I feel sorry for you that you have that challenge, but that won't affect the British position. You have French boats in British waters, and if you don't behave and comply with the rules, you can pull them out or we'll push them out.
Well, it looks like we can continue this. Go ahead, Michael Schumann.
Well, we have to see what happens to Article 16, right, of the Northern Ireland Protocol. From my assumption is you're going to pull it, right? You don't want to have that anyway, so you're going to have a hard border in there, and that will further deteriorate the situation and proves to me that you have been playing false all along.
Right, so on a serious note here, Derek.
The issue of the Northern Ireland border is a matter for the European Union, and France has given up its competence and power to the European Union. It is no longer a sovereign nation. That's why Britain wanted to withdraw from the European Union, because we want to be in charge of our own destiny. And until the people of Northern Ireland decide they want to join up with ERA, they will remain part of the United Kingdom. It's called democracy, and if that's what they vote for, that's what they get. At the moment, they say they want to stay part of the UK, so as Prime Minister of the UK, the job is to make sure that happens, and no amount of French arm-waving will change that situation. You're conflating two different issues, and one is directly with France. And we understand where that difference lies, and we will not be pushed around.
Michael Schumann.
it's hard to me. I mean, I don't play the French role very convincingly, probably. But as I said, I'd rather look at it from a German perspective.
Okay.
And
the Germans
and
are too reasonable. You don't wave your arms around enough.
Well, let me ask you.
But that is what you need. You need a reasonable approach to that.
Right.
Takes the emotions out of it. Takes the historical connotations out of it. And find a solution where both sides can preserve their face and still de-escalate the situation. I simply refuse.
But politics is an emotional business. I spent 33 years an elected politician, and it is a
politician.
And that's what Chancellor Merkel didn't understand when the Prime Minister of Britain, Mr. Cameron, said, I need to do something about immigration levels in Britain, and if I don't, we're going to lose this. And Angela Merkel said, no, you will not lose it. The Brits are not going to vote to leave the European Union. Well, she got that call wrong. So sometimes being clinical and calm can backfire if you don't understand the emotion behind someone's political position. And the Brits, as I say, can be a belligerent nation, but surprisingly, they're quite an emotional nation too. They may not demonstrate it, but it's just under the surface, and when it bubbles out, it's very difficult to get back into the bottle.
Okay, I've got to squeeze this question in here. Michael Schumann, if I may. I'm looking at the Ireland's EU Affairs Minister, Thomas Byrne, Michael Schumann, who has tweeted in solidarity with Paris, quote, the partnership between France and Ireland through Brexit has been strong. The trade and cooperation agreement is clear. Vessels fishing in traditional waters should be allowed to continue. So is the EU taking the side of France in this case?
Well, France is still a member of the EU, and of course they're closer to us now than it's the UK, but it wouldn't be wise to exasperate the situation. And let me just give you one more reply to the gentleman on the other side. I've been witnessing Angela Merkel for 16 years, and I've never seen a politician as unemotional. There were only two times where her emotions, the decision, there was on the migration issue, the energy, and you can reasonably view that these were worse decisions. So, I would still advocate for a reasonable and calm approach to this.
Okay.
I think the position of the ERA commentary from Southern Ireland is understandable, but it's not the European Union. The European Union speaks on trade matters and on fishing agreements, and the European Union has said it's not just about the permits, about whether you qualify for a permit. And the handful of French fishing vessels who've been so far excluded from British waters have been excluded because they do not qualify under the permit arrangement. So if somehow they can find the documents to show they fished in these waters only one day a year for the past 6 years, only one day, not a whole week or a whole month, then they would get their permits. But because they can't comply with the paperwork that the EU has said they must under the agreement, then that's where the problem lies. So the noise is off from Southern Ireland, from any other country individually, don't really matter. The European Commission is the one who is the guardian of this agreement, and that's why they're keeping well out of this little fight.
Okay, I'd like to get to the worst case and the best case scenario. Best case scenario, problem will be solved. Okay. Worst case scenario, we talked about blockades here, and the fears of it prompted Prime Minister Boris Johnson to send two Royal Navy gunboats to the area. This much we know. And then France sending two of its own coastal patrol vessels before the French trawlers retreated. Michael Schumann, do you think that, what does that show? I mean, does that take it to another level, that there's going to be some kind of clash there perhaps?
No, I refuse to believe that. I simply cannot imagine that we see a form of armed conflict over such an issue. But it is language of force. And even if it stays that way, it's quite disturbing, as I repeatedly said. Right? And it is these kind of conflicts that we once saw we had dealt with in Europe, and we will not see them again. And what British and the French are experiencing, the Germans and the Poles could experience in the future, it's not good to see those demons from the past being let loose again and have this kind of confrontations. That didn't end well we're in a situation, in geopolitical and global situation right now, where our priorities should lie elsewhere.
Okay. And Derek Conway, what would prompt this to be resolved? What moves needs to be taken from one side or the other, or mutually, in order for this to progress onto the positive aspect?
Well, I understand that the Department of Britain and the part of the EU Commission that deals with this are trying desperately hard to help these smaller fishermen, French fishermen, comply with the permit regulations. And if they can do that, they'll get the permit, and then hopefully everyone can be happy. If they can't, then they either tear up the agreement, or the fishermen are not allowed to fish in British waters. The British Royal Navy is there to defend British shipping in British waters. So if we see the violence that happened last time from some of the French fishing industry, which can get a little out of hand from time to time, when some of the fishing boats from Jersey were attacked physically, then of course the Royal Navy should intervene and try and prevent that, as should French boats, actually, because they're there to keep the peace and maintain harmony on the waves. So I hope it won't get to that, but you could see it happening. And that's the danger of all the rhetoric that's going on. So hopefully let's see these small fishermen get their permits and they can go on doing their small fishing, because it means nothing to the whole nation of France and it means nothing to the whole nation of Britain economically, but emotionally it clearly means a great deal. And armed conflict has come from far lesser things, so I hope it won't spiral to that, but you couldn't say it's impossible.
Okay, we'll end it there. Thank you, Derek Conway. Very good to see you, Derek Conway there. Former member of the Parliament of the United Kingdom, and Michael Schumann, thank you, Chairman of the Board of BWA, who spoke to us from Verona. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the Spotlight. From Mikhail Tatlé, the entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum, welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. death comes to one of them, he says, "My Lord, send me back." That I might do righteousness in that which I left behind. No, it is only a word he is saying, and behind them is a barrier until the day they are resurrected.
Brothers and sisters, regarding these two verses, the Almighty Allah says, حتى إذا جاء أحدهم الموت قال رب ارجعون, until when death comes unto one of them, he says, "My Lord, send me back again." And the next verse where it says, لَعَلِّي أَعْمَلُ صَالِحًا فِيمَا تَرَكْتُ, that I might do righteous in that of which I have left behind. At the end it says, وَمِن وَرَائِهِمْ بَرْزَخٌ, but behind them is a partition, إِلَى يَوْمِ يُبْعَثُونَ, until the day when they shall be raised up. Speaking of barzakh or partition, we have concluded previously that it is a thing, a kind of stage that is standing between the two things, and in this case, it is standing between this world and the Day of Judgment, and it is not just for the good people or the bad people, it is for both of them. Also, by starting to have a look at the different traditions of the infallibles, we found out that sometimes it is the grave itself. This is how barzakh is referred to in some of the traditions, and it means that the punishments and rewards given between this world and the hereafter is the grave or barzakh itself. Let's look at some of the other traditions of the infallibles, explaining more about this concept of barzakh. Another tradition from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says that one day a man came to him and said, "It is said that the souls of the believers after death will enter the chests of green birds that fly around the divine throne." The Imam said, "No, that is not the case. The believer is more respectable in the eyes of Allah than to be confined within the chest of a bird. The souls of believers are rather clothed in bodies like their own bodies of this world." So, this tradition, dear listeners, is referring to a substantial body that is somehow like this material body here, but it is as immaterial as the intermediate world they are living in that time.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of his divine
in this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jews.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Ayyuhanna
insights into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
There is also another tradition cited in the Book of Kafi, attributed to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. The Imam was asked about the souls of the believers, and he answered, "They are in the chambers of paradise. They eat the foods of paradise, and they drink its drinks. They say, 'O Allah, establish the day of resurrection and make the promises you have made to us come to pass.'" So this is explicitly suggesting that they are living in a state, they are getting their rewards of good deeds and righteousness in this world, and they are asking the Almighty Allah to even make His promises come to pass by starting the day of resurrection, by establishing that day of resurrection. There is yet another tradition by the Imam in the same book, where he says that when a believer passes away, the souls of the believers will gather around him, the other believers, and ask him about those who were in the world and whether they were alive or dead. If he says that such and such a person had died, but they did not see him among themselves, they will say that that person had certainly fallen, which means he has gone into hell. So certainly paradise and hell in the narrations that we talked about are not real ones. They are the states in the intermediate world, close to hell or close to paradise, and they are not those that after the day of judgment the people will experience. So overall, many narrations speak of the pressure and punishment of the grave and the questions put to its inhabitants. Many narrations talk about the contact of the souls of the dead with their families and observing the conditions therein. And there are also some narrations mentioning the incidents that had happened to the Prophet ﷺ on the night of his ascension and his meeting with the souls of the prophets and messengers. They are all suggesting that there is a kind of stage called Barzakh, or the intermediate world. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. website www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahan Abad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The night in March 2021 that 33-year-old Sarah Everard was arrested, raped and murdered by police officer Wayne Curzons. He has been handed a life sentence, but since the murder, public trust in the force has plummeted. In 4 years, 2,000 officers have been accused of sexual misconduct, including rape. Nearly two-thirds of them have faced no further action. And a quarter of misconduct hearings are closed to the public. Britain's most senior police officer has promised a thorough investigation into the Met's culture, and the Independent Force for Police Conduct says it is dealing with a slew of new referrals since it changed the criteria for abuse of power for sexual purposes.
But is it about referral criteria or something more ingrained and sinister? Curzons was nicknamed the rapist by his colleagues, so why wasn't he weeded out earlier by the Met?
Climate change is sort of steroids for the weather. That's what experts say. From the northernmost to the southernmost points of the Earth, nowhere and no one is immune to this crisis. In India, people have been devastated by frequent heat waves.
We are affected a lot by this unbearable heat, and us poor are hit the hardest.
And so are Canadians.
It's just unbearable. It's impossible to be out.
This year, July was declared the world's hottest month ever recorded. A recent study shows if the world's emission of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases continues at the same level, in 30 years' time, there will be a climate change apocalypse. That means outdoor life in parts of the Middle East and North Africa would be impossible, regions that are already facing long periods of extreme heat.
We are very tired and cannot stand in the sun. Our situation is very bad. We are exhausted.
Researchers are now warning that even animals and plants are in danger. In a bid to survive, some countries are already looking for new ways to adapt to these intense situations. In Bangladesh, one of the countries worst affected by the extreme weather in recent decades, farmers are developing floating seedbeds and salt-resistant rice to avoid unpredictable conditions.
This is the digital age. We saw on YouTube how greenhouse farming works. We tried it on a smaller scale, though. I am doing greenhouse farming this year on 8,000 square feet of land.
Estimates show that $5 trillion a year are needed by 2030 to find measures to fight global warming. But despite signs of progress in a few sectors, the majority of the tasks required for curbing the rising temperatures still seem to be far-fetched. And many are now saying that the upcoming United Nations conference, COP26, is the last major chance to galvanize a collective effort to fight climate change.
Unless there are immediate, rapid, and large-scale reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, we will be unable to limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius, and the consequences will be catastrophic. 26 this November must mark that turning point. By then, we need all countries to commit to achieve net zero emissions by the middle of this century and to present clear, credible, long-term strategies to get there.
All these are reminders that the fatal consequences of this human-induced crisis are threatening our planet now more than ever before.
Afghanistan has welcomed the recent remarks by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, who called for greater unity between Sunnis and Shias. This according to a tweet by a spokesman of the political office of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, Mohammad Naeem Wardak. He further said the Taliban are aware of the nation's enemies' scheme and work for tightening brotherhood among Afghan people.
The U.S. has always been trying to deepen the schism between Muslim sects, both after the invasion and after the withdrawal. They don't stop their conspiracy, but the Islamic Emirate is aware of it and will never let the enemies of Islam reach their goals. However, they target Shias, but in fact, they are against all of us.
Afghan people have also welcomed Iran's leaders' remarks. In a conference titled Islamic Unity Week and the Responsibility of People in the Afghan capital on Tuesday, the participants said Islamic unity should be part of culture in Muslim world.
Prominent Islamic scholar and the late founder of Iran's Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khomeini, in a very critical point of time came and named this week as Islamic Unity Week, so that all Muslims keep their unity and brotherhood. We all have the same God, Prophet, and Qibla. Then let's benefit from these mutual values for our unity and make it a culture.
Addressing the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference in the Iranian capital, Iran's leader touched on the U.S. campaign to instill sedition among Islamic countries with the help of its proxies. He said the recent unfortunate and distressing explosions at mosques targeting Muslim worshippers in Afghanistan are among such incidents that were carried out by Daesh. Earlier this month, Daesh terrorist group conducted two deadly attacks against Shia community in Afghanistan. Following the attacks, Muslim leaders noted that such incidents are meant to divide Muslims in the war-torn country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
France's latest unemployment data showed a small improvement, but unemployment remains nearly 8%, at least officially. 5.9 million people remain unemployed, which is just a fraction less than the all-time high of 6.3 million in 2017. Back in September 2008, the total jobless numbered just 4.5 million. That means French unemployment has risen over 30% since the start of the Great Recession. With re-election just 6 months away, many say that Macron is running out of time to devote resources to the jobless or to devise a new system of accounting. Macron campaigned on a promise to bring unemployment under 7%.
His effort or his promise to increase employment by changing labor laws that would make France more attractive to foreign investors just hasn't worked. This idea of bringing in migrants for cheap labor to keep wages down is a real issue. So it's a big problem for Macron.
Under Macron's predecessor, François Hollande, the jobless rate increased 44 out of 46 months at one point. To change that, Hollande controversially started excluding part-time underemployed workers from the official count. Macron went one better and declared that just looking for work once in the past month no longer makes someone unemployed. Macron also began revealing jobless data only once every 3 months to avoid media discussion of the unpopular issue.
We have to really distinguish between what the official unemployment rate is and what the unofficial unemployment rate is. And if we take what the potential workforce is, it's much, much higher. And it's really amazing because the service sectors, like restaurants and bars and stores and stuff, can't find people to fill positions. And the reason is they don't pay enough.
For years, many French economists have said that the official unemployment rate is undercounted by a third, which would put the real unemployment rate at well over 20%. The Macron era had been one of constant economic unrest, but the coronavirus pause seems to have ended, with protests recently increasing in number and intensity. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
President of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat, has sent a stern message to the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, slamming the world body's inaction regarding Saudi Arabia's bloody war on Yemen.
Unfortunately, Saudi money has weakened the role of the United Nations in Yemen and has changed the world body's political position. The United Nations' primary concern should be the humanitarian situation in Yemen, but it has failed to consider that.
In the message sent to Antonio Guterres on United Nations Day, Mashat called on the UN to stop manipulating the facts in Yemen for political ends. He said the world body has effectively covered up for Saudis during 7 years of war under blockade. He added that the UN failure to renew the mandate of the Human Rights Council's group of eminent experts is yet another proof of how Saudis are bribing their way through the world body.
It was not so much a message of congratulation as it was a message of blame for the UN's negative role regarding what the Yemeni people have been subjected to over the past 7 years. It's a clear message that the UN must play its role and that the international community has failed morally in Yemen. We are ready to support the continued work of the United Nations and its humanitarian organizations and facilitate their operations inside Yemen, but on the condition that the United Nations protects the Yemeni people and stops Saudi violations.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war on Yemen on March 2015. The war has killed tens of thousands of people, including women and the children, and has pushed the country to the brink of famine.
Yemenis say the United Nations continues to apply double standards when dealing with the ongoing Saudi crimes against millions of Yemenis. They believe that the Yemeni army's operations are legitimate as it is defending the sovereignty of Yemen, which is the only way forward to put an end to the humanitarian crisis in the country. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Small in number, but they have big voices resonating along the streets of Oldham, Manchester, calling for Israeli arms company Elbit Systems to be shut down. This is the Elbit site in Manchester, and the event here, organized by several pro-Palestinian groups, who accuse Elbit of providing Israel with predatory drones and other military hardware, accusing it of complicity in Israeli war crimes and in abetting Israel in terrorizing the people of Gaza. Elbit Systems UK, a subsidiary of the Israel-based company of the same name, employs over 500 people and has 10 sites in the UK, including 4 factories.
Israel is an apartheid state. It's a racist state which is preventing Palestinians from living their ordinary everyday lives. And indeed worse, it's starving them, it's bombing them, it's killing them, it's depriving them of their lands and homes. And it has been since 1948. This factory here, Elbit, is the largest private Israeli arms factory. There's 10 outlets in the UK, and they are all making drones and weapons which go to kill Palestinians.
Apart from supplying Israel with weaponry, Elbit is also a major supplier of sophisticated technology to the British military.
That Britain and Israel have a clear, incestuous, revolving door type of relationship between each of their military establishments and their arms companies. We are fighting back against that here.
In August, pro-Palestine activists took their fight to another level. Direct action against the same site in Oldham, causing disruption to the firm's operations. For their actions, they often face intimidation, arrests, and possible prison time. But they say they're unfazed. Events such as the one today have led to increased public awareness about Elbit and its operations and growing calls for its closure. That, the activists say, is one important step towards a free Palestine.
The United Nations has warned that more than half of Afghanistan's 39 million population is facing acute food insecurity as hunger is rising and children are dying. We can't feed people on promises. says the head of the World Food Program, David Beasley. He has urged world countries to step up life-saving assistance to resuscitate Afghanistan's economy.
We have been left on the streets for 3 months now. We haven't received any aid despite calls on the United Nations. Most women and children are sick or starving. Why are they doing this to us? Aren't we human beings?
Nowadays, there are no jobs for us, but there is poverty, hunger, and disaster. We are a family of 10, and wondering what to do and how to feed them. Winter is closing in, and prices are rising. People will die if the government and other countries don't take any action.
Here, Afghan social activists have come together on behalf of millions of vulnerable people and families to protest the critical humanitarian situation in the country. They're calling on the U.S. to free Afghans' assets and compensate them for its war crimes in Afghanistan.
We are chanting for our rights. The U.S. has always treated Afghans with cruelty. Our protest today has two aims. First, we are calling on the U.S. to free up our own money and let aid flow in. Second, the U.S. must compensate us for the war crimes it has committed and the damage it has caused.
The Taliban takeover weakened an already fragile economy that was heavily dependent on foreign aid. Western countries suspended aid, and the World Bank and International Monetary Fund also halted payments. Immediate global aid is now crucial to meet the most basic humanitarian needs of Afghans as winter approaches with no jobs, cash, or prospects for the people. Afghans and humanitarian bodies have warned of imminent disaster if proper action is not taken. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Iran is a land of ethnic diversity, and that is reflected in different languages, cultures, and of course, music. After over a one-year hiatus due to the coronavirus, the Iranian Folk Music Festival has once again hosted musicians from across Iran, each playing their local tunes using their indigenous instruments.
I come from the northern Khorasan province. I am so happy to be part of this music festival to share my city's music with my fellow Iranians from other cities. I've brought a local instruments such as sonal, which is an ancient Iranian woodwind instrument, and dhol, which is a local type of drum.
We in Sistan and Baluchistan province play sitar, which we also call tambure. We also play qaychak, which is a type of a bowed lute similar to kamanche. We usually play in celebrations.
Every night during the three-day festival, different local ensembles took to the stage to perform, so the audience could listen to Kurdish, Baluchi, Azeri, and Arabic tunes in a matter of a few hours. And this is my favorite part. On the sidelines of the festival, bands from different ethnicities get together and improvise. This is where music transcends languages and interconnects various cultures.
Music is a language that needs no translation. We may not understand each other's languages, but as you could see, different people are interacting peacefully through music.
It's so interesting to see artists from different parts of the country perform together. This is the true meaning of national unity that binds us despite our cultural differences.
Organizers say that's the main purpose of holding such an event, to unite different ethnicities through the language of music.
Music is an integral part of society's identity and history, and Iran is no exception. So the festival tries to both introduce the local music of different ethnic groups in Iran while establishing peace and friendship among them.
Organizers also hope that the festival would help revive Iran's folk music, which has long been overshadowed by some of the heavily invested genres, like pop.
Through music, it's easier to grasp the ethnic diversity in Iran, because music itself is a language, a universal language that speaks the beauty of differences and peaceful coexistence of different cultures. as one nation. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Kerman.
The sanctions by the United Nations Security Council against North Korea over its nuclear and missile programs have been in place for more than a decade. The UN now acknowledges that the U.S.-backed sanctions were at least partly responsible for North Korea's food and medicine shortages.
DPR Korea has never been more isolated from the international community than at this point in time. This is having a dramatic impact on the human rights of the people inside of the country and dampens hopes of achieving sustainable peace and security on the Korean Peninsula.
The special rapporteur was echoing and backed the call by some member states for sanctions relief for North Korea.
There must be a move back towards the spirit of multilateral cooperation that enabled the foundation of the United Nations in the first place.
This weekend, the South Korean and U.S. envoys on North Korea met in Seoul, with South Korea calling for an official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War, and the U.S. agreeing to discuss the proposal later. The U.S. has often repeated that it's willing to meet with North Korea anywhere, anytime, without preconditions. U.S. officials have now added that the country holds no hostile intent toward North Korea, while at the same time pressing for stronger implementation of the controversial United Nations Security Council sanctions. South Koreans expressed their hope the international community could at least provide humanitarian aid.
The United Nations need to support North Koreans so that they don't continue to suffer from starvation.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in has sought to build peace with North Korea, arranging summits and proposing other avenues of engagement, while the U.S. maintained a hard line. President Moon will leave office next spring. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Senate Democrats rushed on Tuesday, 26th of October, to nail down the details of a groundbreaking tax on billionaires' wealth, part of an elaborate menu of tax increases to finance a significantly scaled-back bill that would strengthen the societal safety net and address climate change. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Jonathan Weisman, Emily Cochrane, Alan Rappaport, Katie Edmondson, and Zolan Kano-Young. The piece is titled, Democrats Hammer Out Novel Plan to Tax Billionaires and Corporate Giants. Stay with us for more. Democrats rushed on Tuesday, 26th of October, to nail down the details of a groundbreaking tax on billionaires' wealth, part of an elaborate menu of tax increases to finance a significantly scaled-back bill that would strengthen the social safety net and address climate change. Democrats' plans to pay for about